You're welcome, Neil.
This is hell.
Manufacturing Dissent since 1996. This is hell, and let me start by saying happy Diwali to all my Hindu neighbors. It's the Festival of Lights and the 5 days that are the most celebrated in Hinduism. So why am I mentioning it here on This Is Hell? Because War on Christmas. You are listening to God's favorite radio show. Name the god, any god. Prove me wrong. This week on an abbreviated 1 hour, 15 minute This Is Hell, first, I'll give a monologue that may get me shot, but after that, we'll be talking to a guest who has not appeared on This Is Hell since the last century. You may have heard, seen, or read reports of the role the U.S. government played in the massacre of over 500,000 Indonesians in 1965 and 1966. If you haven't, stay tuned. If you have, we'll be speaking with Brad Simpson, editor of that report, U.S. Embassy Tracked Indonesia Mass Murder in 1965. Why is this report of a 50-plus-year-old crime significant today? Aside from the desire to set history straight, it appears that the same abusive military behind that massacre is rising to power and building a challenge to the current president using the same Red Scare tactics. Brad is the founder and director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project and an associate professor of history and Asian studies at the University of Connecticut. Following Brad, we'll give you some listener feedback, and then we'll have a return of yet another guest, but he's been on much more recently than the 20th century. This week, author, organizer, and educator Max Haven posted the Aurora magazine article, Financialization, Precarity, and Reactionary Authoritarianism, which is a prescient excerpt from Max's 2014 book, Cultures of Financialization, Fictitious Capital in Popular Culture and Everyday Life, a book that was released in paperback just last month. Max argues that financialization is at the root of all our lives. Problems that have less job security and stability is as bad as apartheid when it comes to racism, is pitting us against our neighbors, and the breeding ground for authoritarianism. We'll end this week's shortened show by revealing our guests on next week's 4 hour, 40 minute marathon of an extravaganza of a show, but that's next week. I'm your bitter, blind, broke, gap-tooth radio show host, Chuck Mertz. Producing this week's This Is Hell is Alex Jerry. Alex, what's new by you?
I developed a signature cookie.
Oh, really? What's that?
It's called the Odie Boy.
Can you share what that is online?
It only has oats in it right now. But I think that's a good start. So if you have suggestions for what else to put in my Odie Boy, email Alex.
I'm going to say eggs would be helpful.
Oh, yeah.
This Is Hell is broadcast live without interruption on WNUR 89.3 FM, Evanston, Chicago Sound Experiment, streaming live online at our website, thisishell.com, podcast shortly after at the same place, thisishell.com, now airing an abbreviated one-hour version on Sunday mornings in Moscow, Idaho, on KRFP and on Lumpen Radio in Chicago's South Side. Brave enough to be live, dumb enough to be goofy, stupid enough to think that we could be a regular part of your weekly hangover. This is Hell, and Alex has this week's hangover cure.
This week's hangover cure is, well, it depends on the time of day. In an article we've mentioned on the last few weeks of shows that was posted at Cosmopolitan, headlined, 8 nutritionists reveal their hangover cures. They quote Kim Pearson, a nutritionist working in partnership with the natural health company, whatever that is, betteryou.com, saying, it depends on the time of day and how hungover I am. I like porridge made with almond milk, topped with raspberries and nut butter. If I'm out and about, I'll grab a free-range egg mayo sandwich on granary bread from my favorite restaurant. Later in the day, I quite like smoked haddock fish cakes topped with poached egg on a bed of spinach. So that makes this week's hangover cure. If it's the morning, porridge with almond milk, raspberries, and nut butter. If it's midday, an egg mayo sandwich on granary bread, and if it's later in the day, have some smoked haddock fish cakes topped with a poached egg on a bed of spinach.
nut butter, your home for anti-social media. This is hell. What I am about to say may get me killed. That's why I'm a little bit nervous and stumbling over my words. Okay, maybe shot. All right, I'm pretty sure the person I'm about to offend is a horrible shot, as he only has a handgun. So let's say fired upon. Let me be honest, nothing's probably going to happen because the kind of threat you get from a troll usually stays under the bridge where they tend to lurk. No, I wasn't targeted by neo-Nazis from Gamergate because we interviewed Zoe Quinn, who is the target of rape and death threats over an erroneous report about her posted by her ex. Those freaks are too busy running the country with the Trump administration. Instead, I was attacked online by a racist, the kind of provocative jag who likely is so filled with shame all they can do is provoke and jag. It all happened on my high school alumni Facebook page. The high school from which I barely graduated is situated about a mile north of the infamous 8 Mile Road, which was seen as the dividing line between Detroit and the suburbs. When I was a kid, that dividing line might as well have been a wall. The mayor of the crappy suburb where I lived once said he was going to keep all Detroiters out by lining 8 Mile with armed supporters. Luckily, Detroit had a mayor like Coleman Young, who responded that he would do the same to keep all of us out of Detroit. Back then, in the good old days that so many on my high school Facebook alumni page yearned for, the town where I was raised was nearly 100% white and nearly 100% racist. It was violent. I was almost run over on a neighbor's lawn by a group of teenagers driving around trying to run, well, anybody over. My block had a mass murderer living on it who was taken in by a SWAT team that had to come from Detroit because we didn't have much of a police force despite nearly 50,000 residents. I mean, what reason is there to police white people? Drugs were easy to get, including awful drugs like PCP. I once sent a guy out to go get coke, and all he could find was PCP. I'm no fan of coke, but Jesus, PCP? And PCP was all the rage among white kids in the neighborhood. Guns were too. On my block, I could go to a garage where a dealer I assumed was illegal had them all on display. Very handsomely on display, I might add. I assumed they were illegal because the dealer was barely 18, and I seriously doubt 18-year-olds were allowed to sell guns back then, and I'm not even sure if they can do that now. My childhood home was broken into 3 times, and the gun dealer's garage was too. We called the police when our place was broken into. Oddly, the gun dealer did not. Yep, those were the good old days that everyone at my high school alumni page missed so much. In fact, it led to a conversation that began with this statement. Sorry to say, as a graduate of 1992, and lived in town most of my life, that it won't change what it has become. I moved my kids out in fear of being hurt or shot and watched nothing short of riots. My garage was broken into, $25,000 stolen, my daughter's Jeep recently stolen, and today a drive-by that hit a neighbor sitting on the porch. It has turned into the new Detroit. You can keep it all, no matter what you call it, will not change what it is. Yeah, I know. Who keeps 25 large in their garage? That is unless you have an illegal gun dealership in that garage. That, no matter what you call it, is a reference to the town formerly being called East Detroit, but racist, as Kid Rock so succinctly depicts in his only not horrible song, It's Still East Detroit to Me. Racist changed its name back in the early 1990s. To East Point, hoping somehow potential residents wouldn't notice that it had nothing to do with the far more affluent suburbs of all the Grosse Pointes. And man, were they racist. I mean, cross-burning on African Americans' lawns racist, just for moving into town. I couldn't take the virulent racism and got out of town real fast, and relative to people I met after leaving, I was pretty damn racist. It's what happens to you when you live in an all-white, hate-filled racist town, that horrible stench seeps into your very being, and even if you think you're Dr. King relative to them, the bar is real, real damn low. There were hundreds of comments in the discussion of how bad my hometown has become now that, you know, they moved in. One person commented that they were concerned for the people who were renting her home, not realizing that a very big problem with East Detroit is that it used to be mostly home-owning residents and now it's mostly renters. The instability caused by renting, open to the whims of your landlord to raise your rent for improving your property or the neighborhood, getting more attractive because of a community caring, leads to insecurity and a complete lack of desire to keep up your home, which in turn leads your landlord to not care and believe you deserve observe the horrible living space landlords often refuse to maintain, especially when the landlord happens to be a racist white person and the renter happens to be non-white. These same people who yearn for those good old days and lament what my hometown has become posted about an upcoming class reunion recently. Despite four rental halls in town, they booked it in a hall two suburbs away. When I asked why they decided not to bring business back to the town they supposedly love, giving back to the community, they said it was too late, reservations had been made, and then took down the entire announcement. Seemingly out of shame. Not only is white flight still happening in the form of class reunions, it was also further institutionalized last year with the School of Choice program, which allowed students from the district to go to, well, other nearby schools, i.e. more white suburban schools. As the Detroit Free Press described it, School of Choice was creating white flight in Metro Detroit again. And when students leave the local school district, their parents lose interest in helping out local schools. There were hundreds of comments in the discussion of how bad my hometown has become at our Facebook alumni page. Now that, you know, they moved in. One person commented that they were concerned for the people who were renting her home. I already mentioned that. But the obliviousness didn't stop there. One commenter went on this diatribe, and keep in mind, nearly every post was filled with grammatical errors while talking about how great the schools used to be. One commenter said, "You can thank the trash from Detroit for ruining this great city. They effing ruined everything. Effing people are effing animals." When another commenter replied, a commenter who is white and still lives in East Detroit and was upset at being called an animal, the racist went on this tirade. "You little snowflake, no one called you a thief." After saying the problem was all the dirtbags now living in the city, he explained, "Unless you are black, shut the F up. Because that's who all these people who agree with me are talking about, you retard." Unfortunately, this is when I stepped in, posting he's simply trying to provoke. It's what racist trolls do today. He doesn't even know the real definition of snowflake. Snowflake refers to someone, usually the alt-right, Milo, and Nazi sympathizers, whose immense white fragility causes a meltdown when confronted with the most minute deviation from orthodox white supremacy. This is all a continuation of how Snowflake historically refers to people who are against the abolition of slavery. The commenter disagreed with that analysis, surprisingly, because his sensitivities were hurt, like a snowflake. His white privilege was questioned, and he replied in a way you'd expect, "You're just a keyboard," well, P-word that I can't say on the radio, and yes, he used the wrong version of "your" because, of course, he did. I asked at that point why he uses a fake name while I use my real name, which would seem to contradict his point of me being a P-word. He then requested I come say that to his face, to which I explained I could not because, unlike me, he doesn't make his Facebook page public, so I don't get information like where he lives or of where I can say it to his face. I know I shouldn't have called him a coward for not using his real name on Facebook. I'll defend anyone's right to be anonymous, but there are certain words fascists and racists hate, and right there at the top of the list is racist and coward. It really freaks them out. It was at this point that I noticed his profile picture, a gun holster strapped to the dashboard of his car. His next post triggered some community violation and was immediately taken down by Facebook. I thought to myself, did he just make a violent threat against me? Is his profile picture dog whistling that anyone he engages with is subject to lead poisoning? That's when I exited the conversation, leaving behind only an image that offers the three steps on how a dog whistle works. First, you blow as hard as you can on a shiny new dog whistle. You can't hear a thing. Second, Fido sees you blowing on a whistle that doesn't make any noise. Finally, Fido runs to you and barks until you stop because he thinks you've gone insane. No, my hometown is not hell, although landlords are doing their best to make it one. But it was hell when it was filled with racists like those on my high school alumni page, and every time I visit it, I can see the racist post, the dog whistling that is so loud and grammatically correct that every time I drop in, I can easily say, "This is hell." If you want to hear "This is Hell" over the air on your local radio station, assuming you still have one, and impose our content upon your neighbors, email us your local radio station call letters to chuck@thisishell.com, chuck@thisishell.com. Coming up on this week's This Is Hell, the U.S. role in a massacre that killed over half a million Indonesians, listener feedback, it says feed bag here, how financialization fuels racism and leads to authoritarianism, plus what's happening on next week's marathon for our 40-minute This Is Hell. Live from the rotting corpse that is broadcast radio, This Is Hell. It's been over 50 years since a purge killed over 500,000 Indonesians, and finally evidence is coming to light of the U.S. role in that mass killing and the role played by the Indonesian military. The U.S. continues to support to this day. Here to explain, Brad Simpson is founder and director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project. He is an associate professor of history and Asian studies at the University of Connecticut and the editor of the report, U.S. Embassy Tracked Indonesia Mass Murder 1965. Brad, welcome back to This Is Hell for the first time in, I think, 19 years.
Thanks a lot, Chuck.
Yeah, thanks a lot for not having me on for 19 years.
I think I was in grad school the last time you had me on.
I'm pretty sure you were. So I want to make sure that people don't just think that this is something that lives isolated in a vacuum in history, that it has an implication and effects on what's happening today in Indonesia. Jim Narikas of Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, who's been on our show many times, he wrote this week that there's a story at the New York Times website on Wednesday with the headline, U.S. stood by as Indonesians killed a 500,000 people, papers show. Prior to your report being released, you were quoted in the Washington Post saying the documents would confirm an additional detail that U.S. officials were aware of the army-led mass killings of alleged communist members, Communist Party supporters, that's the PKI, the Indonesian Communist Party, and members, and actively encouraged them. They knew the army was carrying out a campaign of extermination against overwhelmingly unarmed civilian who were unaware of and had no involvement in a September 30th movement, which is the alleged coup by communists that did not take place. So in your estimation, did the U.S. do nothing, or was the U.S. government more actively involved in the massacre?
Yeah, I think there's a mistake in some of the reporting on this question that the United States was merely a bystander. And I think that this is a sort of common trope in political scientists and journalists and others writing about mass killings and genocide. We see this most vividly in Samantha Power's book, A Problem from Hell, which is a long history of genocide in the 20th century, which essentially argues that the U.S. committed sins of omission by standing silently by as other countries carried out genocide until it finally saw the light and began to actively intervene in the name of humanitarian intervention in the 1990s in places such as Kosovo and Bosnia and the like. And rather, what we see in many of the worst cases of genocide in the post-World War II period is that the United States was either, if not an active bystander, a willing accomplice, and in some cases, an instigator of mass killings. In the case of Indonesia, we have to sort of step back and look at the longer history of U.S. relations with the government that had been in power since independence in 1949 of President Sukarno, who was an anti-colonial radical, a fervent nationalist who opposed the U.S. war in Indochina and who was becoming increasingly radical in his own politics and forging a somewhat tactical alliance with radical political forces inside his own country as a way of balancing the many political tendencies between the army and Muslim organizations and conservative nationalists and leftist forces such as the Indonesian Communist Party, which was the largest communist party in the world outside of the Soviet Union with approximately 3 million members and an additional several million in affiliated organizations that helped organize women and peasants and workers in rubber plantations and oil fields and other areas of the Indonesian economy. And for many years, the United States had been watching the growth in popularity of the Indonesian Communist Party with a great deal of concern to the point where after the Communist Party came in second in national elections in 1955, the U.S. helped to sponsor a civil war in Indonesia, working with factions of the Indonesian armed forces in the outer islands to attempt a breaking up of the Indonesian archipelago in the name of challenging the concentration of power and wealth in the main island of Java. This civil war ended up turning out quite disastrously for Indonesia as well as for the U.S. when it became clear that the United States was essentially backing a civil war between two anti-communist movements within the same armed forces who were simply fighting over the spoils of Indonesia's wealth and natural resources. And in the wake of this disastrous covert operation, one of the largest covert operations of the post-war period for the United States, in which an estimated 10,000 Indonesians were killed, the Indonesian Communist Party emerged as probably the largest and most politically powerful mass-based movement in Indonesia, and probably the only real force preventing an army takeover of the country. And it was about this time that the United States began to develop a sort of long-range strategy of attempting to work more closely with the Indonesian armed forces by providing them with military training, with equipment, and with increased political support as a way of trying to gain their allegiance in Indonesian internal politics, as well as the allegiance of the Indonesian government in the Cold War. At the same time, the Central Intelligence Agency began some low-level covert operations aimed at trying to keep tabs on anti-regime elements within the armed forces and to try and lay the groundwork for eventually promoting a conflict between the army and the PKI. And American officials realized, beginning in the early 60s, that only the annihilation of the Indonesian Communist Party could help to achieve its main goal of dampening Indonesian nationalism, of preventing the continued sort of leftward tilt of the Indonesian government, and of ensuring that Indonesia would remain in the Western fold as one of the most important countries in Southeast Asia, and indeed, in the eyes of many American officials, one of the great prizes of the Cold War.
And this isn't something, like I said before, that only exists in the past, because there's this from Reuters on September 27th. Indonesian police deployed 30,000 personnel to guard an anti-communist rally as the country's military chief and hardline groups stoke fears of a hard left revival in the world's most populous Muslim nation. The Reuters story adds that government advisors said the fomenting of a red scare was aimed at Indonesia's reformist president, Joko Widodo, widely known as Jokowi, and long falsely accused of being the descendant of communists. How much are we seeing a political resurgence of the anti-communist zeal that led to the massacre? Are we seeing yet again another red scare?
Well, what we see in Indonesia is the use of anti-communism as a sort of proxy for fighting other political battles. And the groups that are continuing to sort of beat the drum of anti-communism are largely conservative Islamic organizations, members of the armed forces, and sort of youth paramilitary organizations, many of which were active participants or allies of the military in carrying out these massacres in the 1960s. And we should see the revival of the sort of rhetoric of anti-communism in Indonesia as somewhat equivalent to the debates over the Confederate flag or debates about the Vietnam War. The debates taking place in the United States about the Confederate flag, we know, are not actually about the Confederate flag itself, but about the racism and structural white supremacy for which the Confederate flag stands. In the same way, we can see that the use of anti-communism as an excuse for trying to break up meetings of human rights activists or LGBT activists in Indonesia or others who are opposed to attempts by the military and more hardline Islamic groups to increase their power are merely using anti-communism as a club. Because for decades, Indonesians were propagandized by their own government and by every institution in their life to believe that anti-communism was a foreign invasive force that was a mortal threat to the Indonesian body politic and to the very existence of the nation. And so many Indonesians, most Indonesians, until the overthrow of Suharto in 1998, the dictator who was in power for 32 years following his ascendance in 1966, Indonesians were raised from birth to believe that the hundreds of thousands of communists who have been killed in 1965 and 1966 have been killed as a sort of spasm of popular revolt against an Indonesian, against a communist attempt to try and overthrow the nation and impose a communist dictatorship, and that the destruction of the Communist Party was what saved Indonesia. And so every time we see a revival of anti-communist politics, it usually comes in the context of attempts to challenge the power of the armed forces or attempts to challenge the power of other anti-democratic forces, which are attempting to resist the assertion of minority groups, of religious groups, minority groups, of human rights activists, of women's activists, of anyone who is trying to make Indonesia a more democratic and pluralistic society. And so recently there was a meeting of the human rights group LBH, one of the most important human rights organizations in Indonesia, which was broken up by a violent group of sort of rent-a-thugs who were claiming that the human rights meeting was in fact an attempt to revive communism in Indonesia. We can see the same in the attacks on the current Indonesian president, Joko Widodo, or Jokowi, who is being tarred with what we might consider something of a blood libel by arguing that he is descended from communists, as if the blood of communism that allegedly flowed through the veins of his parents somehow infects him and makes him a traitor to his own country. This is a sort of Indonesian analog to the racist sort of birther theories, which were propagated by Donald Trump and Dinesh D'Souza and others when D'Souza sort of infamously argued that the anti-colonial sort of infection of Barack Obama's Kenyan father somehow ran through his veins and made him un-American or anti-American. In the same way, anti-communist forces, or there really is no, there's no communism in Indonesia, but forces invoking anti-communism are using anti-communism simply as a way to try and discredit their political opponents, knowing that the very idea of anti-communism is so deeply ingrained in the minds of many Indonesians that they will recoil from it rather than questioning why it is that these forces continue to sort of beat this drum of anti-communism 50 years after the Indonesian Communist Party was basically exterminated as a political force inside the country.
Back in 2010, during the Obama administration, Human Rights Watch condemned the U.S. for resuming aid to the Indonesian military due to reports of abuse and a lack of reform or accountability that had led to a U.S. ban on military aid to the country. By 2013, Congress okayed $1.56 billion in aid to the Indonesian military. How much do you think today's continued military aid by the U.S. to Indonesia gives the reportedly abusive military any approval or tacit endorsement for not only what are allegedly ongoing abuses, but also for the massacre of over 500,000 Indonesians in 1965?
Well, the continued provision of military assistance by the United States sends a strong signal to the Indonesian armed forces that it can continue to enjoy impunity for alleged and demonstrated human rights abuses. We should be clear that the Indonesian military is not the force that it was in the 1980s and 90s, when it really was the dominant political force in the country and had the full backing of the Indonesian government and was really the sort of power behind the throne. The current president, Jokowi, he is not a military man, like many of several of Indonesia's civilian presidents since 1998. He does not have strong links to the military. He doesn't have a military background. And as a result, while the military does not have the same direct influence over him as it did over previous administrations, such as that of the former defense minister, Yudhoyono, who was a military man and a general, Jokowi nevertheless feels like he must sort of make inroads with the military in order to maintain their political support, because this political support is somewhat fragile and subject to competing political pressures, especially from Islamic organizations and others who wish to challenge Jokowi in the name of asserting their own increasing political power inside Indonesia. The Indonesian military continues to operate with relative impunity when it comes to human rights abuses, but the level of human rights abuses is generally reduced from what it was in the 1990s and early 2000s, when the military was running rampant in Aceh and had recently destroyed East Timor as it exited the country after a 1999 UN-sponsored referendum. The primary place where human rights abuses continue to take place in Indonesia is in the far eastern territory of West Papua, which has long been a sort of hotbed of nonviolent as well as occasionally armed resistance to the Indonesian military on the part of the indigenous peoples of West Papua, who've long resented the sort of colonial overlordship exercised by the Indonesian military and its political allies, who are working very closely with Western mining companies such as Freeport-McMoRan, which for many years operated the largest gold and copper mine in the world in West Papua, and continues to extract enormous wealth from the territory, while the population of West Papua remains largely impoverished and politically disenfranchised compared to the rest of their Indonesian counterparts. So we should recognize that the Indonesian military is not as strong of a force as it was 20 years ago, but that it remains a very potent force in Indonesian politics, and that the provision of U.S. military assistance sends a very strong signal to the Indonesian army that it can't operate with impunity. The majority of U.S. military assistance to Indonesia now comes in the form of counterterrorism assistance. After the cutoff of military assistance to Indonesia in the late 90s, largely the result of activism by human rights activists and solidarity activists around the country, working with sympathetic Congress people, the Bush administration, after September 11th, wanted to restart military assistance to Indonesia. And as it did in many parts of the world, they simply renamed what had formerly been military assistance into counterterrorism assistance. And then the spigots once again opened up, and the U.S. was able to convince Congress that providing military assistance to Indonesia was newly vital in the context of the so-called war on terror. Inside Indonesia itself, the so-called war on terror was used as a sort of green light for committing a whole host of human rights abuses. And the U.S. helped to train a number of paramilitary counterterrorism forces, which engaged in quite severe human rights abuses against Indonesians in the name of fighting radical organizations at the time, such as Jamaah Islamiyah, which was a sort of al-Qaeda offshoot that operated in Indonesia. But the continued provision of this kind of military assistance in the name of anti-communism or in the name of counterterrorism does send a signal to the Indonesian armed forces that as long as they use the right code words and frame their needs and demands, both for public and private consumption, as stemming from the so-called war against terrorism, that they will continue to enjoy both the political and the military support of the U.S. government.
And I couldn't help but notice that there seems to be a divide going back to 1965 and 1966 between Islam and communism when it comes to Indonesia. To what degree are the actions taken by the U.S. back in 65 and 66 a cause of the more, and maybe even the actions today, a cause of the more radicalized Islamist groups in Indonesia?
Well, in the 1960s, there was Indonesian Islam was still a largely moderate political force. There have always been regions of the country where more conservative variants of Islam were practiced, especially in the northern Sumatran territory of Aceh. And this is a result of the historic links between northern Sumatra and Islamic trade routes coming from the Middle East. But the Islamic political movements in Indonesia were overwhelmingly moderate for much of Indonesia's history. There were was a small Islamic rebellion called the Darul Islam, which ran from the late 1940s until the early 1960s. And the presence of these armed Islamic movements that sought to create an Islamic state in Indonesia created lots of fear among the Indonesian armed forces about the rise of what we would now consider to be political Islam. After the September 30th movement, which was an alleged coup attempt by members of the leadership of the Indonesian Communist Party and middle-ranking members of the Indonesian armed forces, the army launched this campaign of mass murder against alleged members of the PKI, as well as affiliated organizations or anyone who could be associated with the left in Indonesia. And in this campaign of extermination, the military has found ready and willing allies in several Islamic movements and organizations in Indonesia, as well as the sort of youth wings of these movements, which were formed into informal paramilitary militias. And the army, which at the time was still relatively small and weak, armed and helped to train some of these militias and use them to help crack down and kill hundreds of thousands of alleged Indonesian communists. And at the time, the Islamic movements and organizations thought that they would be rewarded by the military for their service, as they saw their service to the nation. But once Suharto came to power, he very quickly tried to tamp down and return these Islamic organizations to a subordinate political position inside Indonesia, and created a lot of resentment that festered for many decades afterwards. In the 1980s, Suharto, as his political power came increasingly under challenge, sought to actually encourage and embolden Islamic movements inside Indonesia to rely on him as a main source of patronage and support. And this was a period in time when a couple of hundred Indonesians actually went to Afghanistan and fought with the so-called Mujahideen rebels who were then fighting the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan with U.S. assistance. And it was during this period when some Indonesians came back to their country following the Afghan wars with ready infusions of money from Saudi Arabia, from Egypt, and elsewhere, that began to sort of incubate more virulent and radical strains of political Islam inside the country itself. The overwhelming majority of Indonesians still practice a very moderate form of Islam, and it is completely false to suggest that Indonesians in general are in any way sympathetic to the militant Islamic movements which have operated in the country since the late 90s and early 2000s. Far more Indonesian Muslims have been killed by these radical Islamic groups than have Westerners or anyone else. And they are, broadly speaking, very unpopular inside Indonesia, but they enjoy an ability to organize and to seek allies, occasional tactical political alliances with other organizations, including the armed forces, to try and achieve their political goals. And in the last few years, there has been these groups have shown an increasing aggressiveness and an increasing willingness to try and make extreme demands in various parts of the country to impose what they view as more conservative Islamic policies, such as requiring Indonesian women to wear head coverings, sort of beating young people who are wearing immodest clothing. But a lot of this sort of extremist activism has been directed at political opponents, or has been directed at gay and lesbian activists as a way of trying to impose a more harsh regime of public morality, even as many Indonesians oppose the efforts of these organizations to try and radicalize what has historically been a very moderate vision of Islam that is practiced by the vast majority of people in the country.
One last question for you, Brad. We've been speaking with Brad Simpson. He is founder and director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project. You can find out more about them at nsarchive2.gwu.edu/Indonesia, or just go to our website and click on the link. And you can also follow them on Twitter at NSArchive. One last question for you, Brad, and as we do with all of our guests, it's the question from hell, the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer, or our audience is going to hate your response. A document you provide states that just prior to the massacre, both Stanvac, that's Standard Vacuum Oil Company, which was a joint venture by Standard and Mobil Oil, and Shell, two of the three largest foreign oil companies operating in Indonesia, were negotiating to complete the transfer of ownership of local refining capacity to the Indonesian government, a plan scuttled later in the year under intense pressure from U.S. officials. In your estimation, how much was any U.S. complicity in the U.S. in the 1965 massacre driven by the bottom line, driven by U.S. corporate interest desire to make profits through foreign investment in Indonesia?
Well, I think we should be cautious about drawing too direct of a connection. What we do know is that the concerns of American officials for the prospects of Western oil companies in Indonesia was one of the most important considerations behind their opposition to Sukarno and to the Indonesian Communist Party, which was agitating for a nationalization of oil in Indonesia. As the massacres were getting underway, it became clear to U.S. officials that the Indonesian armed forces, the military, in the name of nationalism, was determined to press ahead with the nationalization of oil refining capacity in Indonesia. And in a quite dramatic move, U.S. officials threatened to literally cut the Indonesian military off at the knees and refused to provide them with any economic or military assistance unless they halted the proposed nationalization of refining capacity. To the point of threatening to stop cold U.S. assistance to the army's campaign to try and wipe out the PKI, considering that the threat to Western capital was, in fact, more grave than the threat posed by communism in Indonesia to the pursuit of Western interests. And I think that this sort of illustrates in a pretty powerful way that anti-communism was both a political threat to American interests in places like Indonesia, as well as a geopolitical and economic threat, given the alliance that many communist parties forged with local political nationalists who are calling for such things as the nationalization of oil reserves, of mineral reserves, of Western companies, and that American officials, as a result, considered the extermination or crushing of such political movements as indispensable for the maintenance of Western access to countries like Indonesia, where they could get oil and other natural resources for both Western companies as well as for global markets.
Brad, I really appreciate you being back on our show. I promise you'll be on our show again before the next century happens. So thanks so much for being back on. Brad Simpson, founder and director of the Indonesia and East Timor Documentation Project, editor of the report, U.S. Embassy Tracked Indonesian Mass Murder in 1965. Thank you so much for being back on the show.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. This has truly been hell.
All right. Take care. For those of you who are upset with any Russian meddling in the U.S. election, supposedly, that happened, go read U.S. Embassy Tracked Indonesia Mass Murder in 1965 so you can have a little bit more of a historical context about the potential innocence of the United States when it comes to meddling in elections. The kind of stuff that starts fights at the dinner table or whatever meal you currently happen to be enjoying. This is Hell. You can now become a supporter of This Is Hell via Patreon. If you become a regular Patreon supporter, not only will we show you our appreciation by sending you some This Is Hell subvertising stickers, but you also have access to special perks, including every week getting a classic interview from our back catalog of 20 plus years of on-air conversations selected by me or Alex with a new up-to-date introduction on why I selected that interview or Alex did for our Patreon supporters. And in the future, you'll get additional bonus gifts at thisishell.com/support. This week, Patreon patrons will get a 2010 interview we referenced during our conversation with San Juan correspondent Dave Buchan, who is telling us how we can help the people of Puerto Rico last week. So, Patreon patrons will get the interview we did with David Holm, co-author of Just Give Money to the Poor, The Development Revolution from the Global South. It's a great argument for the best way to help people out who need it, instead of going through NGOs that often have competing interests when doing what can be good work but also can be completely useless, which is also something that came up in our conversation last week with Ashley Dawson, author of Extreme Cities on the Impact of Climate Change. We want to thank those who have already signed up as Patreon supporters because with your help, we'll finally get our studio up and running as well as rebuild our 20-plus year archives of shows. Thanks this week goes out to our newest Patreon patrons, Tommy S., Jed, Emily S., Stephen D., and This Land Collective. That makes 141 Patreon patrons so far, and we'd really like to be up to 200 by Thanksgiving. So show your support and sign up for Patreon, or just do some other things you can do to support This Is Hell by going to thisishell.com/support. Coming up, we'll talk the evils of financialization and tell you who's on next week's 4-hour, 40-minute This Is Hell, live from the nightmare of want. This is hell. Financialization leads to racism. Financialization leads to authoritarianism. Financialization leads to disparity, inequality. It destroys communities. It's a threat to our planet. And it's the backbone of today's screwed up economy. Here to tell us what makes financialization so damn evil, author, organizer, and educator Max Haven wrote the Roar magazine article, Financialization, Precarity, and Reactionary Authoritarianism. Welcome back to This Is Hell, Max.
It's a pleasure to be here.
The article we will be discussing today is an excerpt from Max's prescient 2014 book, Cultures of Financialization, Fictitious Capital in Popular Culture and Everyday Life, which was released last month in paperback. Max is the co-director of the Radical Imagination Project, and you can find out more about them at radicalimagination.org. You can also go to maxhaven.com, and you can follow him on Twitter at Max Haven. So you're concerned about the precariousness caused by financialization, as University of London professor Kostas Lapavitsas has written. Financialization conveys the penetration of the financial system into every nook and cranny of society, including housing, education, health, and other areas of life that were previously relatively immune. Evidence that financialization represents a deep transformation of mature economies is offered by the global crisis of 2007 through 2009. The penetration of finance into the everyday life of households has changed the outlook, mentality, and even morality of daily life. Financial calculation evaluates everything in dollars and cents, transforming the most basic goods, above all housing, into investments. Its logic has affected even the young, who have traditionally been idealistic and scornful of pecuniary calculation. How aware do you think the public is of the negative impact of financialization? In particular, how aware are those who are angry with what the United States has become, from less stable job security, stagnating wages, greater wealth disparity? How aware are they that it's all linked to financialization?
Well, I think there is an awareness of the effects of financialization in the sense that the vast majority of the population who don't happen to be extremely wealthy feel like somebody constantly has a hand in their pocket taking their money. I mean, part of the financialization scheme is not only the fact that we're constantly in debt or constantly being forced to sort of invest in various things in order to protect ourselves from the market. It also has to do with the increase of fines, the increase of fees, and the sense that you can't turn anywhere without basically having to pay someone. The problem is that though I think a huge number of people are extremely aware of the effects of this, they're not aware of the cause. So they're not aware that this has a systemic characteristic. And instead, they see many white people imagine that the hand in their pocket is that of racialized people, of quote-unquote special interest groups that the government is allegedly giving handouts to. So there's an awareness of what is happening, but there's not an awareness of the system that's behind it. And in the absence of an awareness of that system, we see the rise and growth of kind of revanchist and furious forms of racism and sort of marginalization.
You write how within today's financialized world, precariousness is the norm, not the exception. It is worse than many such manifestations precisely because it is so successful in privatizing precariousness through the logic of individualism and competition. How much do individualism and competition cause job insecurity? Is an embrace of individualism at odds with having steady and secure jobs? Because I often hear the same people praising individualism and competition, but complaining about the lack of work stability.
Well, I mean, on some level, individuality is a good thing. I mean, many of us have been arguing for years that people need to have some sort of sense of agency over who they are, how they define themselves, and how they express themselves. The problem is that when we tie our sense of individuality to the market and to our ability to compete with one another for money, we do a grave injustice to our own individuality and our own creativity and imagination. And we also contribute to a system that's sort of objectively destroying us and destroying the world. But I mean, we've been sold the lie that in order to lead the life that we want, in order to actualize ourselves, in order to express our creativity and imagination, we need to throw ourselves headlong into the market and adopt the sort of mantle of the entrepreneur or the financier. But the problem is that is actually contributing to a system of vast inequality and suffering, where even those who most enthusiastically take up this social role of being the investor and the entrepreneur, even among those who most enthusiastically do so, the vast majority will fail. And when they fail, there is no safety net anymore to catch them. So it's a pretty destructive ideology, to say the least.
To what degree do you think our lack of being critical of the system is rooted in racism? Because I found this to be one of the more fascinating parts of your writing. Do we refuse to blame the system and instead embrace individualism while turning our back on community because it somehow excuses or rationalizes or gives logic to racism?
I think absolutely. And, you know, there's a long history of capitalist inequality justifying itself through racism. I mean, we know from the historical record and also from the anthropological and scientific literature that whiteness is itself a social construction. It is a flexible category that certain populations get included in and not included in historically. And we can see that with the way that the Irish went from being a racialized population to being understood as a white population, Jews, Southern Europeans as well in the United States. And all this took place in order to divide and conquer the working class and working people from making common cause. So race has always been used in America and elsewhere as a means to divide people from looking at who their real enemy is, which is the looters in society, the very wealthiest population that is controlling people's labor, that is exploiting the planet, and that is destroying society. Now, what's different, perhaps, in our present era is that these forms of racial divide-and-conquer tactics have been tied to this kind of financialized individualism. So on the one hand, this means that we're given this idea that we've now, because there are no longer, allegedly, there are no longer legal or sort of policy-oriented exclusions of racialized people from participation in the market, as there were, for instance, under Jim Crow or previous regimes, that now somehow we're all equal to compete with one another and thrive in a market society. But of course, the reality is that if you look at net worth, if you look at earnings, if you look at practically any measurement, you can see that racism, especially against Black people, but also against Latino people, against Indigenous people, and against other racialized people in the United States, Canada, and other countries, is in some ways more prevalent than it has ever been. But we are furnished with this mythology that if we all just compete, if we all embrace entrepreneurialism, a sort of investor-like individualism, we can all succeed and thrive. And within that framework, racism, the fundamental systemic and structural racism that is at the bedrock of our economy, becomes invisible. And people blame individuals for their failure to thrive within a poisoned and poisonous system.
You write, it is vital to note that in North America and Europe and in different ways elsewhere, this precarious vitriol cannot be separated from the history of race and racism. Older modes of racial enslavement, apartheid, and segregation serve the same function, similarly allowing those read as white to posit a superior form of humanity, which both occluded a shared precariousness and elevated the material wealth and security of whites at the expense of immiserated, exploited, and impoverished non-whites in different ways in different times and places. To what extent do you think the public doesn't see financialization as morally unacceptable, as racist, as slavery, apartheid, and segregation, because it is seen as being without any immorality or morality, as being objectively equal to all due to it being simply a tool of the market?
I think that's absolutely true. There is a sense that markets are colorblind, that the market simply rewards hard work, entrepreneurialism, and inventiveness. But of course, if we go back into the history of the market and we go back into the history of financialization, we can see that it has always been otherwise and still is otherwise today. I mean, just very briefly, we talk about financialization and finance, the so-called FIRE sector, as it's called, of the capitalist economy, that's finance, insurance, and real estate, as being sort of the crux of a financialized economy. And let's just briefly go back through each of those different things. Finance, like high finance and banking, insurance, and real estate. Well, what is the fundamental institution of finance? Is the joint stock corporation. The joint stock corporation was invented in Holland and England explicitly as a technology to use to engage in colonial adventure overseas. the cost of financing a voyage overseas to go on a trading mission or on a settler colonial mission or to dominate another group of people or to take slaves from Africa. These are extremely expensive, extremely risky ventures. Many financiers need to come together and have some sort of technique or technology in order to be able to finance this. This is where we get the corporation that still persists to this day. I mean, the country that I live in Canada was founded by the world's oldest corporation, the Hudson Bay Company. The United States, to a very real extent, at least the English part of it, was founded by the Virginia Company. So on a very real, deep level, the fundamental technology of finance has always been tied up in the histories of race and racism. Similarly, the insurance industry, there's a lot of very interesting scholarship that's come out in the last 20 years that links the emergence of modern insurance as an institution to the histories of insuring enslaved cargo, insuring enslaved people, so that their owners could make money whether they lived or died. And finally, if we look at real estate, which is by some estimates 70% of the financial economy, you know, and in your quote from Kostas Lapavitsas that you began with, he notes that this is kind of the crux of how society becomes financialized. Well, the idea of private property, the idea that you can own land, this is a relatively recent invention, though it is crucial to the kind of financialized order. And where does that invention come from, this idea that you can own land? Well, to a very real extent, it comes from both the ideologies and the practices of settler colonialism, where white populations were sent overseas to countries like the United States and Canada to steal indigenous land, murder indigenous people, and clear space for profitability. So even if we go back into history, this question of the financialization has always been racialized. And that leads to the situation now where, for instance, I was just looking at the statistics this morning, you know, only one-third of white people own any financial assets at all. That is stocks and bonds and investments. And that includes their retirement savings. But compared to that, only 10% of blacks in the United States own any financial assets at all, and only 6% of Latinos. So on the one hand, we have a financial system that vastly, disproportionately serves and enriches a tiny, tiny elite, but it is also highly racialized. It has highly racialized characteristics, where blacks, Latinos, and other racialized people are fundamentally shut out from this massive engine of wealth generation.
So you have an addenda, and you write that were I to approach this topic again, I would also stress more centrally the ways in which settler colonialism, as you were just talking about, destroys and denigrates a cooperative relationship with land, most horrifically by seeking the systematic elimination of autonomous indigenous presence on and power on land. So how much is the goal of colonialism, the goal of markets, to destroy a local population's relationship with land?
I think it's absolutely central, and we need only look at the protests against the Dakota Access Pipeline by the Standing Rock Sioux to see how this works today. You basically had a massive alliance of financialized corporations and a financialized government conspire to try and wipe out the last vestiges of indigenous resistance to a colonial worldview. So we can see today that this is simply the modern financialized form of the old Indian wars, of the clearing of the plains, of the attacks on autonomous ways of life and relationships to land outside of that pathological notion that all land needs to be turned into private property. Now, the unfortunate thing is that in North America, in the United States and Canada, whiteness has for a long time been tied to the ability or the dream of owning land. You know, in this case, owning other people's land, it's stealing land. And unfortunately, there's a strong sense that one's autonomy and one's ability to lead one's own life, to lead a life of dignity, is tied to individual land ownership. So we still have a huge mythology of the cowboy, of the settler, of the person who goes away from society or takes a step away from society in order to grow their own food. And to a certain extent, there's a nobility to that. But it still participates in a colonial fantasy of individualized land ownership. What needs to be vanquished in order for the financialized worldview, of which that sort of cowboy mentality is a part, is the idea that we could care for land collectively and that land would care for us, that we could have a deep relationality to the land. And that's something that only now, I think, are non-Indigenous people beginning to see the value of in their partnerships on the front lines with indigenous people to resist this sort of financialized enclosure and destruction of land. So we're only beginning to be able to reclaim a different understanding of our relationship to the rest of the world, the rest of creation, that might actually save us from the incredible ecological and humanitarian catastrophe that's been unleashed by years of colonialism and financialization.
So that's the intersectionality between indigenous rights and the problems with financialization and maybe an issue of class and race. How far would ending financialization, or at the very least muting it to some extent, how far would that go to addressing aspects of racism that groups like Black Lives Matter are protesting?
Well, I think it's certainly part of the picture, but it's not the whole picture. I mean, one of the things I always worry about when I write about precariousness, and something I tried to do in this article, is point out that, you know, we have a myth that we've made about what came allegedly before precariousness. And that myth is usually that, you know, in the post-war period, under the New Deal, under the welfare state, people weren't precarious. And then you see the 1970s, you see the rise of neoliberalism, you see the rise of financialization. And all of a sudden, a bunch of people who previously weren't precarious become precarious. And that's a bad thing. And obviously, there's a measure of truth to that story. But we need to go back and question the prehistory of precariousness, so to speak. That is to say that in the post-war period, I mean, the non-precariousness of white people was bought at the expense, and specifically of white men, was bought at the expense of a whole range of other populations. I mean, the post-war prosperity that came to countries like the United States and Canada was built on the back of neocolonial pillage of the so-called Third World. So there was certainly a huge amount of precariousness all around the world for those years as the United States and Canada and other countries engaged in, as your previous guest was mentioning, these kind of proxy wars of the Cold War to create resource colonies and to create labor colonies for itself through new market techniques. During that post-war period, racialized people in the United States continued to suffer incredible rates of poverty and marginalization. You know, even within the trade union movement, there was not a real awareness of the depth and depravity of racism. Women during the post-war period, I mean, the second wave feminist movement emerged because of the systemic discrimination against and exploitation of women within that post-war economy. So when we think about undoing precariousness, we need to look beyond and desire to return to the welfare state that was in the sort of before the neoliberal financialized era of the 1970s and 80s. We need to think, I think, instead about how do we fundamentally transform our society such that no human being ever needs to feel existentially precarious because of the economy? I mean, I think we just need to ask much more fundamental questions about what a society is for and how we can care for each other. And that's what's going to allow us to overcome the twinned evils of, on the one hand, a financialized system which is transforming us all into, you know, hyper-paranoid individualist risk-takers, and on the other, a system that sees fit to leave whole racialized populations essentially to die, either at the hands of the police, at the hands of poverty, or at the hands of any number of other ills that are unleashed by incredible inequality.
But you're right that, as a result, we should not expect that the almost universal adoption of the free market will lead to any sort of peace or cosmopolitanism in the world, as neoliberal thinkers like Friedrich Hayek or Francis Fukuyama believed, nor should we assume that the financialized age of austerity will prompt such a wave of popular discontent that radical social transformation is inevitable. So neither peace nor revolution will come of financialization. To what degree does the public support the precariousness caused by financialization while being critical of the circumstances it causes?
Well, I think that's the huge problem. That's the huge challenge of our age, is to show that another system is indeed possible and necessary, because the only option that this system leaves us right now is essentially to embrace the kind of order of risk and risk-taking that the sort of paradigm of the financier and the entrepreneur leaves us with. And in that circumstance, what we will see is that populations increasingly gravitate towards electing leaders who promise to help them be more entrepreneurial and more risk-taking, and who promise to protect them from the market in some way. that is essentially an order of strongmen that we are seeing elected around the world. That is, I think, the rise of a new sort of authoritarianism, which has its roots in systemic racism and structural racism. It also has its roots in a long history of modern authoritarian governments. But essentially, we're looking at the public increasingly gravitating towards leaders who promise a kind of thuggish protection for a set of entrepreneurs and risk takers. And is it any surprise then that we see around the world that the kind of clownish reality television entrepreneur or financier becomes the elevated to the sort of figurehead and ruler of the nation? This person can promise to take care of people like him, always inevitably a him, it seems, and increase people's capacity to play the markets, to play the slots. I mean, casinos have always been run by the mafia, and when we turn our whole society into a casino, we shouldn't be confused or surprised when a mafioso takes over.
How much should the fight against white supremacy, white privilege, the Antifa fight against neo-fascism and authoritarianism, how much should it be a fight against financialization?
Well, I think when you look at who's at the head of the financial world, fighting financialization is a fight against white supremacy. I mean, there's practically no people of color at the heads of major financial corporations, and the people who benefit from financialization are disproportionately wealthy white people. That doesn't mean, however, that the system would be any better if we happen to have a few more colored faces in the halls of power. We've already seen the complete failure of that, both on the corporate level and the governmental failure, or on the governmental level as well. So I think that that fight against white supremacy is fundamentally one that would target the financial elite. And we also know that the financial elite, a good portion of them, are very supportive of neo-fascist tendencies because there, you know, there's nothing inherently wrong with authoritarianism for finance. Finance essentially wants a certain kind of political stability in order that it can continue to do its destabilizing work of privatizing and corporatizing every aspect of our society. They, you know, authoritarianism serves financialization quite well. So we should understand that these fights are connected. I'll say, you know, on one level, on the direct level of everyday life, the direct confrontation with neo-fascist organizers, the Antifa fight, is extremely important to be able to protect our communities. But that fight is about creating a shelter for our communities within which we can do the much harder and longer and more sustained work of building alternative institutions, alternative forms of grassroots democracy, alternative forms of social reproduction, that is, alternative forms of care for one another, that will actually allow us to exit and fight the financialized economy for the long term and build the kind of radical alternatives that we need to that cut across the differences of race and class and gender that have been sort of imposed upon us by our masters.
You're right. To the extent that we are made more and more precarious, we brew an existential anger, a self-loathing that can easily be displaced onto convenient others. How much does self-loathing keep us from radical social transformation? How much does that self-loathing lead to a belief that we can't change the system?
I think it's incredibly powerful. I mean, one of the problems is that as financialization takes hold of our imaginations, it reinforces or accelerates a kind of pathological narcissism within our society where we increasingly can't see the kind of social or collective impacts or reasons for people's behaviors and for the situations that face us. So we increasingly blame ourselves for failures, and we can't see that if we want to actually change our life situation, we need to work collectively. Now, I've already kind of spoken about how that works in terms of financialization and transforming each of us into a kind of risk manager and preventing us from seeing that we need a systemic solution. But I would also say that this diffuses a lot of our understandings about how to fight the system as well. Financialization has so trained us to imagine everything as a matter of the individual that we have fixated on individualist solutions to problems of racism or problems of settler colonialism. We imagine that the most just thing that especially those of us who enjoy some measure of privilege within this society although what is privilege on a dying planet, we've convinced ourselves that our job is simply to kind of flagellate and castigate ourselves and to wallow in kind of white guilt around the fact that we are privileged by the system, rather than seeing that there is no way that any amount of individual action is going to be able to overcome a white supremacist system. No matter how virtuous or how saintly you are as an individual, your only chance of overcoming this system is to gather together with other people and to rise up against it collectively, to create new institutions and new relationships that are fundamentally beyond the imagination if we simply fixate on political change as a matter of individualism and individual personal transformation. Those things are important, no doubt. We do need to transform our minds. We need to transform our souls. We need to transform our behaviors. That's a work that we will never be finished doing in a society that has been steeped in racism. You know, hopefully our children's children's children won't have to do it. But that cannot be the be-all and end-all of our politics. We also need to think of ways of transforming the world collectively, and that's going to require a much slower, much more difficult work of building solidarity, building alliances, building alternative institutions at the grassroots level.
And even though we only have a couple of minutes left, Max, I still have to ask you the question from hell, as we do for all of our guests. The question from hell is the question we hate to ask, you might hate to answer. Our audience is going to hate your response. Max Haven wrote the Roar magazine article, Financialization, Precarity, and Reactionary Authoritarianism, which is an excerpt from Max's 2014 book, Cultures of Financialization, that was released last month in paperback. So our question from hell for you is, how much does financialization contribute to self-loathing and shame culture, but also trolling? Is trolling a manifestation of the symptoms of financialization in online social media culture?
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, I think it comes back to this question of individualism. We live in a society where all the tools that we once might have had to try and transform our world together and to come together and understand ourselves as more than simply individuals have been stripped of us. And we have whole new generations who've never experienced those sorts of ideas or the feeling of what it feels like to change society. If you have no sense that you can change society collectively, if you have not grown up with a sense of social movements being successful and being the space where people transform and where they transform each other, then it makes total sense that your entire horizon for politics is online trolling, because at least you have an impact, right? At least in a world that has completely denuded you of any sort of agency, of any sort of potential to transform the world around you, at least when you go online and get a rise out of someone that is your opponent, you feel like you've done something in a world that is completely falling apart all around you. So I think trolling absolutely is tied in with this whole mess. And again, the answer to trolling is not a kind of reverse concern trolling where you go online and either tell people to be calm and be nicer to each other, or you go on and have online battles with people you disagree with. I mean, that can be cathartic, perhaps. I don't particularly enjoy it, but many people do. The answer to it is to say, let's actually come together in our communities. Let's organize. Let's build solidarity. Let's decide now is the time that we are going to actually begin to change this world collectively and rediscover muscles in our collective power that have atrophied over the years. Our ability to come together and provide solidarity, to provide care, and to provide a sense of possibility that comes when you know that there are hundreds or thousands or hundreds of thousands of people with you as well.
Max, I really appreciate you being back on the show. Do not be surprised if I bug you in the very near future to have you back on. Thank you so much for being on the show today.
Thanks so much.
Take care. Bringing you bong-hitting journalism since 1996, this is Hal. This is Hal. Office hours happen this and every Wednesday from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. at Carrie's Lounge, 2251 West Devon. So drop by during that time. If you drop by, we'll give you some free This Is Hal show-related books and some free This Is Hal subvertising stickers. On next week's show, we finally landed one of our biggest whales. George Monbiot will be on to discuss his new book, Out of the Wreckage, A New Politics for an Age of Crisis. Also on next week's show, Alex Vitale, author of The End of Policing. We're also starting our new series based on the book Futures of Black Radicalism. Martha Piskowski is going to report to us live from post-earthquake Mexico. And live in studio, Dave Buchan is going to give us another report on what has happened to post-hurricane Puerto Rico. Want to thank everybody for listening to the show. Thanks to both of our guests this week. Thanks to Alex Jerry. There's only one way to get over all of the problems that we've introduced to you on this week's This Is Hell. That's by sitting down in the lotus position, turning your palms towards the sky, focusing on that burning white dot in the middle of your forehead, and saying these simple words:
everybody's stupid.
My demon is on my butt.
Matt Damon. No.
My demon talks to me in profanity like a sailor. And my demon tries to knock me down, and my demon tries to put me on a hell ride.